Welcome back to Sermons. This is episode 59, entitled Attack of the Seraphim. We're going to pick up the story at the beginning of Numbers chapter 21. And when King Arad, the Canaanite, which dwelt in the south, heard tell that Israel came by the way of the spies, then he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners. And Israel vowed a vow unto the Lord, and said, If thou wilt indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord hearkened to the voice of Israel, and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. And he called the name of the place Hormah. Now, I don't know what the significance is of saying Israel here instead of Moses, you know. Moses spoke for Israel most of the time. And they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. Now, to compass the land of Edom means to go around the land of Edom, because remember, the Edomites still held a grudge against the Israelites, what they're calling Israel here, for the way that Israel had cheated Esau out of his birthright. Because remember, the Edomites are descended from Esau. And if the Israelites tried to go through Edom, there was going to be a war. And the people spake against God and against Moses, Wherefore have ye brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water. And our soul loatheth this light bread. Now, they're talking about manna here, not actual bread. And light bread doesn't mean light in calories or light in color. It means something more like light rations or poor rations. But, you know, these people were always complaining about something or other. But wasn't one thing, it was another. Why'd you bring us out of Egypt? Sure, we were slaves there, but at least we had better stuff to eat than this. Well, the Lord didn't take kindly to such complaints. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. Now, the Hebrew words that are translated here as fiery serpents are Nehashim Seraphim. In the book of Isaiah, these seraphim are called fiery flying serpents, which might give us a clue that what's being talked about here is not a literal snake, but something that flies through the air and shoots out flame and leaves a serpentine vapor trail, maybe. In other words, a jet plane or a rocket ship. Isaiah 6:2 says each of the seraphim had six wings, quote, With twain he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. Now, they use the pronoun he here, making it seem like it's a person. But if you remember, like back when it's talking about the things that are in the tabernacle, like the altar, for example, it has horns, and it talks about his horns. But in any case, Each seraph, which is the singular of seraphim, had three pairs of wings, one near the nose, one near the tail, and a larger pair of wings in the middle. Now, if seraphim were aircraft rather than angels, you know, or what we think of as angels nowadays, this would mean that in addition to the main pair of wings, they had both pitch-controlling canards, as they call them, in the front, and the more conventional horizontal stabilizers in the rear, which would be a little bit unusual, but it has the advantage of providing both redundancy and high maneuverability. An example of this design in a fighter jet is the Russian-made Sukhoi 30, which, if you go to YouTube and search Su-30 Extreme Maneuvers, you can see what this plane looks like and what it's capable of. Make sure you check out the three sets of wings. which matches Isaiah's description of the seraphim. So I'm thinking Numbers 21:6 is not talking about people getting snake bites. I think it's talking about an aerial assault, an attack from above, not by the Sukhoi 30 exactly, but, you know, by something with a similar design. Now, the fiery serpent doesn't just appear in the Bible, by the way. In Slavic mythology, a fiery serpent is a snake demon that appears at night as a glowing fiery rocket, or a flaming broom, or a ball of blue fire. And in the Sumerian tales about the Anunnaki, the gods Anu, Enlil, and Enki are all described as great serpents or dragons. I don't think this means they were evil. I think they got that epithet from how they traveled in jets or rockets that breathed fire like a dragon and left smoke and vapor trails snaking across the sky. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us." And Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said unto Moses, "Make thee a fiery serpent, and set it upon a pole. And it shall come to pass that every one that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, shall live." And Moses made a serpent of brass, and put it upon a pole. And it came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. Now, the King James Version says it was a serpent of brass, but most other translations say bronze, which, you know, seems more likely since Moses lived during the Bronze Age. But whether it was brass or bronze, how could looking at a snake on a pole heal somebody of anything? Well, let's think about what a snake on a pole represents. A snake coiled around a pole is known as the rod of Asclepius, and it's the logo of the World Health Organization and a symbol of the American Medical Association, the WHO and the AMA. You may have heard of them. Those two organizations probably don't think they got those symbols from the Bible. They probably think they originated in Greek mythology, in the pantheon of which Asclepius was the god of healing. He was the son of the god Apollo and an earth woman named Coronis. Now remember back in Genesis 6, when the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took of them wives, any that they chose? Well, that's what happened here. And the result was, as usual, giant offspring. A giant of medicine in this case, Asclepius. And he was often depicted holding a rod with a snake coiled around it. See, all these traditions have a common source. Just as all the flood myths from around the world probably have a common source. So you may think that you're getting something from Greek mythology, or you may be getting it from the Bible. You're really just getting two different versions of the same event, though. Now, I don't think Moses carried around a rod of Asclepius with him, and it would heal whoever looked at it. I think Moses had a lot taller pole erected, and he put the bronze serpent, or maybe a bronze jet plane, I don't know, on it, on this pole, as a marker showing where medical assistance was available. Now today, instead of a pole, it might be a building with that same symbol on its outside wall. And we call those buildings hospitals. Sometimes they'll have a little different symbol, the caduceus, which adds a second snake, making kind of a double helix, reminiscent of the structure of DNA. But whether it's a rod of Asclepius or a caduceus or a red cross, the point is the same. Here's where you can get medical assistance. whether you've been bitten by a snake or received radiation burns from an aerial assault by the seraphim. It wasn't the sight of the snake on the pole that healed the Israelites. It was being able to get to where you could see the snake on the pole. Because if you could make it that far, you could get help. You could get treated. Maybe that's how a snake on a pole got to be a medical symbol to start with. It's kind of an unlikely symbol for medicine when you think about it, unless there is some sort of explanation like this. And the children of Israel set forward and pitched in Oboth. And they journeyed from Oboth and pitched at Ajeabarim in the wilderness, which is before Moab, toward the sun rising. From thence they removed and pitched in the valley of Zered. From thence they removed and pitched on the other side of Arnon, which is in the wilderness that cometh out of the coasts of the Amorites. For Arnon is the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Now, if this was a movie, this is the part, or an old-fashioned movie anyway, this is the part where we'd see a map, you know, with moving arrows or some other kind of animation showing the route that they took. Wherefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord, what he did in the Red Sea and in the brooks of Arnon and at the stream of the brooks that goeth down to the dwelling of Ar that lieth upon the border of Moab. Now evidently this book of the wars of the Lord, or the Yahwehian wars as I would title it, it's been lost. But it was well enough known at the time, at the time that this was written, that the reader would have been expected to be familiar with it. And from thence they went to Beer. That is the well whereof the Lord spake unto Moses, gather the people together, and I will give them water. Then Israel sang this song, spring up, O well, sing ye unto it. Now, I think this song has been lost too, but it must have been on the hit parade back then. Or at least it was a golden oldie. The princes digged the well. The nobles of the people digged it by the direction of the lawgiver with their staves. And from the wilderness they went to Matana. And from Matana to Nahaliel. And from Nahaliel to Bamoth. And from Bamoth in the valley that is in the country of Moab to the top of Pisgah, which looketh toward Jeshimon. More arrows moving across the map. And Israel sent messengers unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, let me pass through thy land. We will not turn into the fields or into the vineyards. We will not drink of the waters of the well, but we will go along by the king's highway until we be past thy borders. And Sihon would not suffer Israel to pass through his border, but Sihon gathered all his people together and went out against Israel into the wilderness, and he came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. It's the same thing that happened with Edom, but this time the outcome's going to be a little bit different. And Israel smote him with the edge of the sword and possessed his land from Arnon unto Jabbok, even unto the children of Ammon, for the border of the children of Ammon was strong. And Israel took all these cities, and Israel dwelt in all the cities of the Amorites, in Heshbon, and in all the villages thereof. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab, and taken all his land out of his hand, even unto Arnon. Wherefore they that speak in Proverbs say, come into Heshbon, let the city of Sihon be built and prepared. And this seems to begin another song, another golden oldie that the reader had probably heard before. For there is a fire gone out of Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon. It hath consumed Ar of Moab and the lords of the high places of Arnon. Woe to thee, Moab, thou art undone, O people of Chemosh. He hath given his sons that escaped and his daughters into captivity unto Sihon, king of the Amorites. We have shot at them. Heshbon is perished, even unto Dibon, and we have laid them waste, even unto Nophah, which reacheth unto Medeba. Thus Israel dwelt in the land of the Amorites. And Moses went to spy out Jazer, and they took the villages thereof, and drove out the Amorites that were there. And I'm guessing these spies, this latest group, knew better than to bring back any negative reports, like the previous set, some of them had done. They were all like, oh yeah, let's go. We'll waltz right through, no problem. They had learned their lesson. You know, it killed off 10 of the 12 because they were negative about their prospects. And they turned and went up by the way of Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, went out against them, he and all his people, to the battle at Edrei. And the Lord said unto Moses, fear him not, for I have delivered him into thy hand, and all his people, and his land. And thou shalt do to him as thou didst unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, which dwelt at Heshbon. So they smote him and his sons and all his people until there was none left him alive, and they possessed his land. Now it sounds like maybe the Israelites got some air support from the flying seraphim squadron. You know, no wonder the Lord told Moses to fear him not. You know, the Yahwehians knew that they had air superiority against any earthly foe. Well, that's the end of chapter 21. And chapter 22 begins, and the children of Israel set forward and pitched on the plains of Moab on this side Jordan by Jericho. Now, I think this means across the river from Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was sore afraid of the people because there were many. And Moab was distressed because of the children of Israel. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, now shall this company lick up all that are round about us, as the ox licketh up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. He sent messengers, therefore, unto Balaam, the son of Beor, to Pethor, which is by the river of the land of the children of his people, to call him, saying, behold, there is a people come out from Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. So, you know, despite all the death rays and the airstrikes and the sinkholes opening up and people getting stoned for any little offense, getting stoned in the biblical sense, that is, there's still a heck of a lot of Israelites, enough to intimidate Balak and the rest of the Moabites. So, you know, he asks for help from this Balaam character, who is some sort of wizard or soothsayer or something. He goes on, come now, therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people, for they are too mighty for me. Peradventure I shall prevail, that we may smite them, and that I may drive them out of the land. For I wot that he whom thou blessest is blessed, and he whom thou cursest is cursed. So in other words, if you bless them, they stay blessed, and if you curse them, they stay cursed. And the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the rewards of divination in their hand. And they came unto Balaam and spoke unto him the words of Balak. And he said unto them, lodge here this night, and I will bring you word again, as the Lord shall speak unto me. And the princes of Moab abode with Balaam. Now, as usual, when the King James Version says, the Lord, that's a translation of the Hebrew word Yahweh. So Balaam is expecting Yahweh to come talk to him. Now, does this mean he's an Israelite? I don't think so. Not according to tradition. He's a Canaanite. And God came unto Balaam and said, what men are these with thee? Now, notice in this verse, the term gets switched. It's no longer the Lord, the Hebrew Yahweh. It's God, the Hebrew Elohim. And Balaam said unto God, Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, hath sent unto me, saying, Behold, there is a people come out of Egypt, which covereth the face of the earth. Come now, curse me them, peradventure I shall be able to overcome them and drive them out. And God said unto Balaam, Thou shalt not go with them, thou shalt not curse the people, for they are blessed. And Balaam rose up in the morning and said unto the princes of Balak, Get you into your land, for the Lord refuseth to give me leave to go with you. Now we're back to the Lord. So whether the Elohim that visited Balaam were Yahwehian or not, he thinks they were, or at least he says that they were. And the princes of Moab rose up, and they went unto Balak and said, Balaam refuseth to come with us. Balaam's ass, said Balak. No, he didn't actually say that, but it would have been appropriate. And Balak sent yet again princes, more and more honorable than they. And they came to Balaam and said to him, Thus saith Balak the son of Zippor, Let nothing, I pray thee, hinder thee from coming unto me. For I will promote thee unto very great honor, and I will do whatsoever thou sayest unto me. Come therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people. And Balaam answered and said unto the servants of Balak, If Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. Now, this is kind of weird. Why does he say the Lord my God if he's not an Israelite, you know, not a Hebrew? Yahweh is the Israelite God, not the Canaanite God, assuming they're right that Balaam's from Canaan. Had he been converted? It doesn't say. The Lord my God is an accurate translation, by the way, by King James standards. The Hebrew is Yahweh Elohe, which is a first person possessive form of Elohim. Now therefore, I pray you, tarry ye also here this night, that I may know what the Lord will say unto me more. What he'll say unto me this time, in other words. And God came unto Balaam at night, and said unto him, If the men come to call thee, rise up and go with them. But yet the word which I shall say unto thee, that shalt thou do. And Balaam rose up in the morning, and saddled his ass, and went with the princes of Moab. And God's anger was kindled because he went. Well, wait, I thought he told him he could go, just as long as he did what he said. And the angel of the Lord stood in the way for an adversary against him. Now, the Hebrew word that is translated as angel here is malak, the singular form of malakim. Malak means messenger. Now he was riding upon his ass, and his two servants were with him. And the ass saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way, and his sword drawn in his hand, and the ass turned aside out of the way, and went into the field. And Balaam smote the ass to turn her into the way. Now this sounds like the ass could see the angel, but Balaam couldn't. And this is consistent with the idea that animals are more perceptive than humans about, you know, so-called spiritual beings, because animals don't have a preconceived notion of reality like humans do. Now, I say spiritual beings. In the past, the Malakim have appeared to be just ordinary men. Apparently, that's not the case in this situation. But the angel of the Lord stood in a path of the vineyards, a wall being on this side and a wall on that side. And when the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she thrust herself against the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall, and he smote her again. And the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right hand or to the left. And when the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she fell down under Balaam. And Balaam's anger was kindled, and he smote the ass with a staff. And the Lord opened the mouth of the ass, and she said unto Balaam, What have I done unto thee that thou hast smitten me these three times? Now, it sounds like the boys in the control room of the Yahwehlian mothership were having a little bit of fun with some high-tech ventriloquism here. But Balaam doesn't bat an eye. You know, he's like the Dr. Doolittle of the Old Testament. And Balaam said unto the ass, because thou hast mocked me, I would there were a sword in mine hand, for now would I kill thee. Well, I guess he's not like Dr. Doolittle. Dr. Doolittle would never say anything like that. But anyway, Balaam's talking to the animals like Dr. Doolittle. And the ass said unto Balaam, am not I thine ass, upon which thou hast ridden ever since I was thine unto this day? Was I ever wont to do so unto thee? And he said, nay. This was Balaam, not the ass, saying nay. And the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way, and his sword drawn in his hand. And he bowed down his head and fell flat on his face. So now the Moloch is revealed to human eyes for the first time. And the angel of the Lord said unto him, wherefore hast thou smitten thine ass these three times? Behold, I went out to withstand thee, because thy way is perverse before me. And the ass saw me and turned from me these three times. Unless she had turned from me, surely now also I had slain thee and saved her alive. That donkey saved your life, in other words. And Balaam said unto the angel of the Lord, I have sinned, for I knew not that thou stoodest in the way against me. Now therefore, if it displease thee, I will get me back again. And the angel of the Lord said unto Balaam, go with the men, but only the word that I shall speak unto thee, that thou shalt speak. So Balaam went with the princes of Balak. And when Balak heard that Balaam was come, he went out to meet him unto a city of Moab, which is in the border of Arnon, which is in the utmost coast. And Balak said unto Balaam, did I not earnestly send unto thee to call thee? Wherefore camest thou not unto me? Am I not able indeed to promote thee to honor? And Balaam said unto Balak, lo, I am come unto thee. Have I now any power at all to say anything? The word that God putteth in my mouth, that shall I speak. And Balaam went with Balak, and they came unto Kirjath-huzzath. And Balak offered oxen and sheep, and sent to Balaam, and to the princes that were with him. And it came to pass on the morrow, that Balak took Balaam, and brought him up into the high places of Baal, that thence he might see the utmost part of the people. And that's the end of Numbers chapter 22. Well, we'll pick it up next time at this point. Until then, keep the faith, saddle your ass and ride. But if your donkey's balky, just give it its head. The ass you save might be your own.